On the show today, I'm joined by my family, my sister, Professor Kerry Arabina, founder of the First Thousand Days Australia, and my daughters, Dr. Kayla Arabina Burns, a medical doctor and artist, and Amy Arabina Burns, a Torres Strait Islander health worker and first-year midwifery student. We talk about our family legacy, our resilience, and our different journeys into health, and how we all weave together to help our mob.
Indigenous Health Med Talk with Dr. Danielle Arabina. Yarning with innovators, trailblazers and community leaders in Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander health and medicine. Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander listeners are advised that this podcast may contain the voices of persons now deceased. This podcast is a General Practice Training Queensland initiative supported by Australian General Practice Training and the Australian Government.
Welcome to the show today. I've got a very special panel with me. It's my family. So I invited all of my mob on to have a yarn with you about what was our reasons for getting into health. So I've got a beautiful story of two daughters and two daughters. So my sister, Dr. Kerry Arabina, and myself are the first sort of people in this story. And then I've got my two daughters. And of course, Kerry has her two beautiful children, Brody and Lauren as well. I was really interested in the idea of how we all came to be inspired to work in an area that we haven't really been exposed to. So we know that Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, there's a big importance for us for role modelling, and that has been historically. We've learnt through watching our elders and our aunties and uncles perform particular tasks or roles within a community group. So Kerry and I, you know, growing up in the 70s, I suppose we could roughly say without giving my age away, but we were growing up in the 70s. And at that time, you know, both of our parents weren't encouraged, or, you know, they left school early. My mum worked on a farm down at near Wynnum, and my dear dad left school at the age of 15 due to his father passing and having to support his family. So both of our parents didn't finish secondary high school and didn't go on to tertiary education. So my mother was always a great advocate for us, for Kerry and I, to get education. And my father worked in construction and worked around predominantly Queensland, but around Australia on different jobs, having a little crane hire business. And Kerry and I very well could have been living in caravan parks and following him around all of the construction sites. But my mum had decided that education was really important for us. And that was something that was instilled. And Kerry trotted off to university. I'll let her tell her story in a minute. And then I followed suit. It was always an expectation that we would go to university. So within our family, Kerry and I are the first people to go to uni. So I'm going to hand over to my big sister, Kerry.
Hello, everyone. First of all, I'd like to acknowledge the traditional owners on the many lands on which we're meeting today and pay very deep and sincere respects to elders past, present and emerging. And it is just a delight to be here having a multi-generational conversation about the importance of health and well-being. As Danielle said, we grew up in a suburb where we were actively encouraged to go through and do education. But we also had a very big vocational program as well, in that mum really facilitated us participating in dancing and stagecraft, and she spent many an hour riding her sewing machine downstairs. So there was tool and sequins everywhere, which of course just made me go, oh my goodness. So I really engaged in stagecraft as well. And when I'd finished high school, I said to Mum, I want to be an actress. And she says, oh, for goodness sake, do you know how many out-of-work actresses there are? Go and do something useful with your life. So I went, all right, then social work's pretty useful. So I went and did social work as a degree, and I spent 4 years, ended up with a young baby during that time, graduated with a child on my hip, and was also experiencing a deeply traumatic early life environment and relationship at that time. So I was experiencing quite a bit of domestic violence. So what I ended up doing was fleeing the state, and I ended up going out to Alice Springs and working there for a year in child protection services. And one of the young people that I was working with had to do a home visit back out to a place called Kintore or Wallangooroo, which is 600 kilometres hours west of Alice Springs. So when I took her out on a home visit, I ended up meeting the partner that I ended up having my second child with, Nigel, and he was living out there at the time doing a whole range of permacultural activities. And I ended up then moving out there after a year and was running the Pinterby Homelands Health Service at the age of 21. So I think that whilst we're able to be actively encouraged to engage with education, there are a couple of other ideas and pursuits that I wanted to explore, didn't get a chance to. And then the early life responsibility of being a parent in a teenage years was really defining in a lot of different ways, in that what I came to realize was how much control I did and didn't have over my sexual and reproductive health. And so there were quite a few issues that happened for me during that time that I sought to resolve. And the resolution of it was by becoming a internationally acclaimed sexual and reproductive health expert that ended up running sexual health and family planning initiatives, doing sexual health and HIV work in the Asia Pacific region, up into China, and then coming back through to Alice Springs, where I lived for 8 years. That was a very, very significant part of my life. And I ended up working in that space for about 20 years after. But that was really about resolving issues that were not very clearly spelt out for me. And I ended up doing that work for about 20 years, which I think was a very good time for me to raise my children, much of which was done on my own. And I needed to have work, obviously. And I found great joy and companionship and collegiality in doing health, but particular kind of health work, which was population-based public health initiatives, where I was able to catalyze really interesting solutions through the innovation, which was generally speaking, either technologically based or medically based. So one of the great big innovations that really helped to galvanize the way that I do my work was through the introduction of the changes from how we treated gonorrhea and chlamydia, from quite invasive techniques to PCR testing. So I was going out and doing a whole lot of work with PCR testing, where we take out entire, the backs of our cars were filled up with spinning machines, and we used to take out labs and do a lot of urine and blood sample collections, and we were able to identify and then eradicate disease. And I think one of the greatest achievements that I've had in quite a few of them, but was to eradicate a disease from in Australia, which was Donovanosis. And that was quite interesting because it was before everything was online. So we had to go back, follow through with a whole lot of case file notes that were kept in remote area clinics, in filing cabinets all over the place. And it was a full-on contact tracing experience where we were able to treat Donovanosis with azithromycin, had incredible results. And we were able to bring the prevalence rate down to a point where it was completely eradicated. I learned a lot by being on that team and how to scale and coordinate activities. So rather than being a practitioner, I became a very effective coordinator. And that is a skill that I have learned and has carried me on for the next work that I'm doing, which is now global in scale and influential in a multitude of ways. So I think that that was my foray into health. I wanted to be an actress, couldn't do that because it wasn't useful, so went off and did something useful.
Yes, fantastic. You know, I can see my children going, Jesus, don't let me follow Auntie Kerry. But I'm gonna segue a little bit and come back to me. And so, you know, my sister was always the shining light at school and very big on the sporting field and the actress. Whereas, I don't know, I don't know if I plodded along, but, you know, I could play some sport, and I got kicked off the choir, not kicked off the choir, but kicked off stage once because we all started giggling on during a song and pissed the teacher off. Yeah, so shame job. But I've got 3 bachelor degrees. My first degree was in communications, and that was really interesting because they, you know, I was recommended to do that because I was good at doing presentations and I was, you know, interested in that sort of stuff. And I also was reading, you know, Kerry had a very, you know, used her circumstances to go out in better health. I got into communications because I was reading a lot of Jackie Collins novels during my holidays and decided I was going to run a male model agency. So I ended up getting into my comms degree and I started off in public relations and I ended up doing a dual major in film and television because I'd rock up to the PR, you know, stuff. And this is in the early 90s now. We've got shoulder pads and women turning up with their briefcases and I'd rock up in a flanny and tracksuit pants and a pair of Converse boots. I was like, And I saw people who looked like me and they were film students. So I went off and did film. But in the background for me, and even prior to that, in our family, we do have some connection to spirit and healing. And so that was sort of always going on for me in the background. I didn't know much about it because we grew up, my sister and I grew up on Quandamooka land down at Wynnum in Brisbane. And we didn't have, our grandmother was up in Cairns and my father was working away a lot. So a lot of this stuff was just me exploring it myself. So I went off and did my comms degree and very much like my sister, I became pregnant at an early age and graduated with my eldest daughter on hip, Kayla Ray. And actually she was, I was in situ because my father thought, because I was wearing this lovely little pinafore and he thought I looked like a schoolgirl who got knocked up on the way to school. That was a direct quote from my father, bless him. So I really got a sense from spirit. I talk a lot about spirit that I was going to be working with women and children. So I read that and I started doing everything. I felt like I needed a piece of paper. So I've got all of the massage, you know, all of these different modalities that I was using. So I was working as a massage therapist and decided I was going to become a midwife. So I actually got into a nursing degree. And then that's when my father got really unwell. So he was diagnosed with diabetes at 50 and then had his first stroke. And as you know, we have with Torres Strait Islander men and Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander men, he became what we call a vasculopath. So very poor blood flow. He ended up with a lower leg amputation. So all of that was sort of happening during my nursing degree. And there was a lot of care that my hubby and I had to do. The girls, my children and I were sort of just cruising along. The girls were, I had a second child who popped along 2 years after Kayla Ray, young Amy. So we did what we can do. My husband was a police officer and helped out a lot with the girls. And so I went off and studied nursing. And then just before I got into my nursing degree, I actually had a phone call out of the blue. And it was from somebody who heard that I was getting into health. And they asked me if I wanted to be a doctor. And I was like, oh, no, I'm here to help people. I don't want to be a doctor. I'm going to be a midwife and help everybody. And then I was sort of in, going through my nursing degree, we'd go out onto the hospital and I'd be watching all the doctors and all the medical students. And I'd have like this little sense of like almost jealousy. And I'd be like trying to listen in to what they're being taught. And so this sort of seed had been planted. And I started getting this voice in my head that was sort of saying, you're going to be doing medicine. You're going to be a doctor. And I was like, no, not me. I'm not smart enough. I didn't do any of the hard sciences or anything at school. I read Jackie Collins novels and got a communication degree. And then I came home and casually told my husband I was going to do medicine. And he's like, wow, when are you working? I said, yeah, not babes. You just got to look after all the kids for the rest of the time. So I basically had a crack at it and got into medicine. And so both my girls were sort of in primary school when I got in. Long story short, got through medicine, now a fellowed GP. And I do my birth work. I work with women. For me, that's women's business stuff. And I go in and I talk about breastfeeding and lactation consulting and birth education medicine. But yes, I go in and act as a doula or a birth support. So now I'm going to handball over to my eldest daughter, Kayla Ray. Kayla was a real nerd and stayed at home a lot, being very studious. She's giving us the squint eye, but Amy and I know that that's true. And Amy was probably a little bit more of my adventurous child. And Kayla just decided, she comes out of the blue and said, I'm going overseas. And I said, oh, okay. So I'm going to cut that story short because she can tell it, but Kayla is currently sitting in Denmark and I haven't seen her since the COVID lockdown commenced. Welcome to the show, Kayla.
Thank you for having me. And hello to all my family I can see in Australia right now. Well, I guess I'm probably not going to be as eloquent as my mom and my aunt, just because I don't have that wealth of experience of presenting yet. But I can tell you a little bit about my story. Like my mom said, I was quite quiet and studious growing up, but that was just my personality and the way that I enjoyed spending my time. I don't think I was anything particularly exciting in my high school years, but I did watch my mum a lot. Like my mum said, she started her own journey into medicine when I was in the seventh grade. So I did spend quite a few of my formative years kind of watching her get her way through her medical degree. And I didn't like to admit it at the time, but I did realize how much that did influence my own decision to eventually go into health. You know, I was very adamant seeing how much work went into a medical degree and, you know, how there were times that my mum did struggle with the workload that she had and the responsibilities that were upon her. I was always very much like, nope, not doing medicine. That looks awful. Not doing that. But then as I was getting into my older, you know, 15, 16 years old, and I did have to start being confronted with the idea that I was leaving school soon and I had to actually make a decision about what I wanted to do, I felt like I couldn't think of anything else that I wanted to do more than to do medicine. So at that point, I then decided, right, I need to get my stuff together. I need to do a specific set of things. I need to reach out to people and ask how I can make this happen. You know, I was very studious and I loved to learn, but I wasn't necessarily like the best student ever. So I started looking into what options there were for students in my position. And I ended up being very lucky in that I met with a few people who worked at the University of Queensland. And these were the people who really encouraged me to actually get my foot in the door. But at that point, they said, we can offer you the foot in the door, but after that, it's all up to you. And so I said, all I need is my foot. So that's what I did. Because the medical degree at the University of Queensland is a postgraduate degree. And of course, me coming fresh out of high school, I had to do something first. I applied and was successful in getting a dual degree in a Bachelor of Science and then a Bachelor of Medicine in Surgery. So I did 2 years of my science degree, and then provided I got through that, I then started in medicine. And during this time, I really enjoyed university in many ways. I really enjoyed the fact that I got to be able to learn things that I was actually interested in. I wasn't necessarily restricted by school curriculums. But one thing that I really did notice was I was very much lacking in creativity at this point in time. That was very sad for me, because art for me was something that I always need to do to de-stress in my life. And so at that point, then I decided, right, how can I mix these two things together? Then I started taking my medicine a bit more seriously when I drew it, or when I be able to kind of figure these things out. I finished my medical degree, and then at that point in my life, it was 2017, I graduated medicine. It was funny, I kind of found myself almost going through the motions a little bit, like I'm on the road, but no one's driving sort of thing. I was almost a little bit disappointed in how my career kind of felt already very set out and how it was going to happen. You know, you do your interning and then you would decide a specialty and then you would do that for how many years and then you'd fellow. And it almost seemed boring in that way. And at that point, I then kind of tried to think about how I could make the journey feel a little bit more natural for me. At that point, then I finally started earning some doctor money and I thought I would take my very first big overseas trip for the very first time away from my family, which love your mum, but needed a bit of a break. And I ended up going to Copenhagen just to see a bit of everything. And while I was here for the week that I was meant to be here, I ended up meeting a very, very special person in my life and who is now my husband. After this, 2-3 weeks that I was away from home, I came back and I was like, Mom, I met him. This is my person. And I'm going to move. And I kept saying to them for a year before I had moved to Denmark, oh, you know, I'm moving and don't worry about it and I'll save money and it's going to be fine. I don't think my mom took me very seriously. And I don't think my family took me very seriously about me actually moving until 3 months before I actually did.
Then we all got really worried. And so Kayla, over there, darling, you're waiting to become a doctor. So you're on the waiting list. So the process is when you go to Denmark, you have to sit the language exam plus a medical exam. So Kayla's on track to do that, but of course COVID and everything else has sort of delayed it a little bit. So there was about an 18-month wait. So Kayla was in this really beautiful space of waiting, and then COVID, she was going to come back and do locuming back at her hospital, but COVID just threw the spanner in the works for that. It was a really interesting time, and we provided a lot of sort of support for Kayla Ray while she was over there. And it was sort of at the end of last year where I had this idea. I said, Kayla, I want to make these patient education sheets for work. Would you like to help me with the writing? Because she's very good at doing assignments and writing and stuff, and do some some research for me. And then we were getting that happening and I said, oh, you know, I'm just trying to think about some artwork for it. And then Kayla just drew this really beautiful, I think it was a heart, the first one you drew. I can't remember. Or the kidney. I just was blown away. I was like, what is this magical stuff that you're doing? And it was sort of based on our lineage and our stories and it blew me out of the water. And I just felt that there was something really special in it. How long were you in lockdown for, Ray?
Out of the last year and a half, we've probably been in lockdown for about 9-10 months. Denmark was one of the first countries to go into lockdown and we only just recently withdrew all restrictions.
Yeah. And so for Kayla, I think the art really helped. Homesickness helped ground you. Kayla's just started painting and drawing. And we'll come back to that, Kayla. I'm going to put a pause on that because now I'm going to flick over to the youngest little bear we've got here, Amy Caitlin. So I literally roared Amy into this world while we were giving birth. And I can talk about birth because Amy has stepped into health in the most, in a way that really resonates with me. So Amy, tell us about you and why you got into health.
Just listening to all of you is just really, it's really embedded to me that I am on the right path and that I want to make a change as well. I'm only 25, so my journey has literally only just began. I feel connected to all of you in a way that is just, obviously we're family, but what we all share is really special to me. We all want to help Mob. We are Indigenous women. We're loud and we're proud for that. That really just resonates with me. I just wanted to say that before I got into it. So my journey has been a very long construed one, I would say. As my mum said, I was a bit of a wild child. My sense for adventure has always been there. I did all right during school. I finished and, you know, mum and dad were very happy that I finished because concentration and, you know, doing assignments and stuff wasn't my strong suit. Talking to people, having confidence, that was my strong suit.
Can I just also pause in there, Amy? Just going to pause. Amy came out, I think, when she was 16 and she's like, mum, you're stopping me from my dream. I said, oh, what's your dream, Amy? She's going, I'm going to be a pro surfer. So Amy was always very, we went down to Nippers and down to Surf Life Saving and Amy actually was a civilian just standing on the beach and went off. I remember Amy went out and did that board rescue of the little kid just when she was there with her mate. So even though you didn't end up being a pro surfer, continue.
Yeah, look, I don't think that's very achievable now because I don't live near a beach. So that's very different
always
to what I've
chosen. Always dream, babe. Always dream. Yeah.
I think I've always been a bit confused at the beginning as what I wanted to do after school. A lot of people that I went to school with knew that they were going to university and I had no idea. So I did what I did best and that was full-time working. I ended up moving out west. I was working with backpackers in pubs and to be honest, had the time of my life. I don't regret anything. And I think it gave me a lot of independence and grew me into the person that I am today. On my travels, back, I met someone that I now am engaged to. We live in Toowoomba in Queensland. That's kind of where my journey started. I went, right, what am I going to do? I can't work in pubs or hospitality. I need to do something more. And growing up and seeing family members, especially my mum and my dad, always working with community, that was just a given. I loved community work. I loved engaging with people and especially helping people. I started my journey as a medical receptionist at a AMS, an Aboriginal Medical Service, where I was then gifted the opportunity to become an Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander health worker. So I went to TAFE and I thought it was the bee's knees doing TAFE and I got that certificate and my family was so proud of me and I was proud of myself for achieving that. Working there, then I was, I just grew so much into Indigenous health, especially advocating for patients and just helping Mob, you know, have the best health journey with the best health outcomes that they could. I then went, okay, you know, I've got itchy feet. I've gone from reception to an Indigenous health worker. What's next? What's next? I don't know if I can be a doctor like my mum and my sister or a doctor like my auntie. It wasn't there. You know, I can't give that much time away because I'm a person who have a very active life and I'm very outdoorsy. So sitting in a room and studying isn't my cup of tea, but I went, I've got to sacrifice something. So I put myself in and I applied for a Bachelor of Midwifery, an Indigenous identified one, and I got accepted. And I thought getting accepted was the best thing ever. And from then, my journey, I'm in my first year of midwifery. I've made a lot of connections and I've been able to work with a lot of women in my community, which is great to be able to give back. I've learned how to be strong and a proud Indigenous woman and to advocate for Indigenous people the right way, which is something that we definitely need, especially in this day and age. So I'm very happy that I can be that for community. Going through uni has been, had its ups and downs, definitely. But the learning and the women's health is just, you know, it's exciting for me to learn that sort of stuff. Being the connection, I've got some girls in my, we've got our own little group at uni and we're all Indigenous girls. And that connection with them is just amazing. There'll be that connection for life. And to have a group of Indigenous women who are, again, loud and proud and will stand up for you and they will keep pushing you along. You know, I think if I went through without doing the Indigenous identified, I don't know if I would be so successful as I am without that support. But that brings me back to why I chose midwifery. It's about women's support. And that's something that I know that I can do, is support and advocate for women in a time where most are vulnerable within birthing, and to be that person who provides cultural safety and cultural awareness as well.
Oh, too good, too good. And Amy, you forgot to mention, I'm just going to toot your little horn for a bit. While you're working at the AMS, you're actually managing, you worked a lot in around smoking and mums and bubs and smoking. And then you're also you worked in the hospital for a bit. And so tell us a little bit about that and when you were attached to the antenatal clinic.
That's also another reason why I became a midwife, was when I was working up at the hospital as an Indigenous health worker. I worked in an antenatal clinic and I would visit women up on the antenatal ward and maternity wards. And I did a research program as well up there, which it was good to do. It was very interesting, but it helped me build a lot of rapport with women in our community. I literally was at the shops the other week and a lady pulled me up and, oh, you haven't met my baby. Here he is. And, you know, I literally stood in Kmart for an hour holding this baby, just having a yarn with her and just checking in and see how she's going. And those are the connections that I love. And even if I don't work in this same community, I know that I will make those connections in a different one. A lot of my time working with mums and bubs and seeing how midwives work and what our women are getting at the hospitals or at the AMS, and kind of going, okay, I can see myself standing there and giving her, you know, explaining things to her in a way that she might understand, or, you know, being that person who can say, you know, you can do this. And that's that advocation that I pride myself in. And I know that I'm that person. If there's something wrong, I'll say something. If there's something that can be done a better way, I'll say it. And that's just who I am. So,
yeah, fantastic. So proud. I'm so proud. I'm just sitting here. I'm trying not to tear up, actually. I'm feeling quite emotional seeing the four of us together. I am tearing up too.
Oh, bless, darling.
I'm just, so proud of all of our individual journeys and how they've all sort of come out and helping community and our mob in different ways. Like our dad, you know, first had an amputation. He was out rural, in a rural place, and perhaps his medical care wasn't the gold standard that he may have got when he was like living near Brisbane. And so getting him here to do that was really important. And you can see that there are a lot of gaps and a lot of people are out there, even, you know, everyone's trying their best, but there's a lot of resources and deficits in area that is beyond the control of the health practitioner and the patient. And so to see us working in different ways to all promote a culturally safe environment or something that can help our people. And as I say to my registrars, it's not just, you're not just treating the person that's sitting in front of you. We're treating their family as well. If they can go back and change one thing about themselves or learn something about their health, they can go back and share with others. It's that ripple on effect. And Kerry, on that thought, I wanted to jump back in to have a yarn with you about your fantastic program that you're doing around First 1000 Days Australia. Can you just give us a little synopsis about that? And I hear that you've got some exciting news in terms of getting some accreditation or CPD points for GPs. So I'm going to hand over to you because your program has a bit of a linkage with Kayla as well and with the work that Amy will be doing in the future.
Absolutely. So again, because of that long experience in sexual and reproductive health, I saw that conception and preconception was a really critical time for the decision-making process about why people became pregnant. I'd also worked in services that supported women who didn't want to continue on with pregnancies. That was a highly politicized area to work in, but that was also an option for women. And I'd also really taken to heart the impact of the experience of the Northern Territory intervention, particularly on men and their capacity for nurturing their children, but how it was seeded into the minds of the public that all of our men are in some way criminalized, they're not able to support their families, they are perpetrators of violence. And most often than not, what I found most damaging in all of this work was the narratives that constructed indigeneity in these kind of contexts. I was at the University of Melbourne. I was the chair for Indigenous Health there for a number of years, and I had worked on a range of different initiatives. They were political in nature because Aboriginal health is naturally political. It was also personal because in them being okay, I was also okay in lots of ways. And I had worked at scales within systems and been able to use technological or clinical technologies in order to catalyze systemic change and transformation. I was sitting in my office one day and this pediatrician gastroenterologist came back from a conference that she'd been to overseas, was talking about this big social movement that was happening called First 1000 Days, which was primarily focusing on the nutrition of mothers during pregnancy in order to reduce the negative impact of the developmental delays that occur because of malnutrition. I said, well, that's fantastic, but we're not just dying from malnutrition. There's a whole range of other things happening in the early formation of our families in that we've got mubs and bubs programs where men are made invisible. So I don't know, immaculate conception, not quite sure we're going to see Jesus anytime soon in our communities, but in terms of the invisibility, that for me was a systemic issue that needed to be addressed. Another thing that was happening for our children was that the majority of children are hemorrhaging into the child protection service delivery system because of the narratives that are given to mothers during that period of time, whether they're neglectful, whether they are unable to parent, whether they have anemic children, all of these labels that happen where we give people an identity, not recognize their experience. So I came up with a concept which was derived from within the Indigenous leadership in Australia called First 1000 Days Australia. And we did a series of symposium where, for example, we brought together pediatricians, adolescent health specialists, and gerontologists to talk about the powerful impact of this first 1000 days from conception through to a child's second birthday across the whole of a person's life. We also then did work on the kinds of research work that was happening, policy initiatives, and another great achievement where I went, yay, in my room was to recognise when in the Prime Minister's report on closing the gap, I'd been able to shift the narrative from birth through to conception. And for me, having that extra 9 months in which we could acknowledge the developmental opportunities that occurred during that time and how both men and women can contribute to that as an experience was really, really vital. The other thing that we were able to do then was, of course, around community engagement and community leadership and how do we actually initiate these sorts of initiatives within the regions so that they are able to be co-designed and co-developed with community. And also then, of course, contributing to the evidence base, which there isn't a lot of work on because a lot of first line or frontline workers are very busy doing the do rather than actually doing the work and then evaluating the impact of the work. So I ended up establishing a research project that got funded by organisations like the National Health and Medical Research Centre, Department of Social Services, the Queensland Government, where we implemented then these kind of different initiatives, which starts from a very different hypothesis to what most of the medical model aspires to, in that when we're designing policy or programmatic opportunities for people to participate in, we start with a problem hypothesis and then we try to go about resolving it. So what we did was change the nature of the hypothesis from a problem to an aspiration, to a life goal. And then we worked from that. And it was very telling one time when I was doing work with single mums groups in Canberra during winter. I said, what do you really want? They said, well, it's bloody cold in our little public housing houses and we've all got thin curtains and our kids end up with respiratory problems and we end up paying a lot for electricity. So what we want is heavy back curtains. And I went, right. So I went back to a network of organizations and said, the mob want heavy back curtains. What are we going to do? Can any of you fund them? And they said, no, but we've got funding available for providing counseling for people, how they feel about not having heavy back curtains. And I went, well, went to the TAFE college. We ended up doing some fundraising for a couple of different sewing machines. They ended up making their own curtains and selling them. So there was an entrepreneurial opportunity that was also underpinning it. So First 1,000 Days Australia was a research project. We were able to do things like catalyze three new look workforces that I've now created business opportunities around. We've been able to export what an initiative has been in an Australian context to both Indonesia and to the Same people in the Arctic Circle. That was an initiative funded out of the Same Parliament. And so I have been to Scandinavia and quite love it up there. Got a chance to go and have a look at all of that. But where my heartland lies is not necessarily in human health, which I think is a bit speciesist nowadays. We're just mammals having mammalian children, really. And my broader perspective is absolutely about environment. And as we're entering into the Anthropocene, which is a whole new geological epoch where humans, a singular species, is the driving force of nature, a lot more of my work and effort has gone into not just human health in the context of institutions, but human health in the context of the environments and the ecosystems of which we live. So First 1,000 Days Australia ended up getting trademarked. I was able to draw it out of the university. It's now an Indigenous business, and we've developed up a whole raft of series of interventions that are being implemented in places like Mount Isa, Townsville, the Moreton Bay region, down here in Victoria. And one of the Victorian initiatives is to do parent coaching in the way that they would like and to find affirmation cards that help serve their purpose. And so that's where the tie in with Kayla has come, because in terms of that work now, we're doing parental affirmation cards where we've got a whole raft of affirmations that are coming through from a cultural context to really support both men and women as carers of Indigenous children, whether they're biologically connected, whether they're part of a kinship network, or whether they're foster children. And Kayla is helping to support that initiative by doing the medical illustration work, which is vitally important to communicate to people with literacy that they may have as a second language or low literacy skills to interpret what this affirmation actually means. So it's been quite the journey. I've got more aspirations that I want to build into First 1,000 Days, but I'm one person and, I've got other businesses that are picking up at the moment, but this one I think will be really precious and very empowering for everyone. And it's beautiful to be able to engage family in this way, because when you engage family through a community organization that's called nepotism, when you engage family through business, that is called legacy.
And I love the legacy, Kerry, that, I want to acknowledge Brody and Lauren as well, that they do amazing work for the earth, for our great mother. And that's something that as Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, we have an innate connection to our great mother. Through our modern life, we've learned to be very disconnected. We all, we're mammals, as Kerry said, we're mammals who hang out in front of Netflix and put the aircon on and buy our food in plastic wrapping without caring about our earth. And I was actually reading a little bit about Eddie Marber and preparing for a presentation with my registrars, and I went down this big rabbit hole and ended up in Indigenous knowledge around for Torres Strait Islanders. And I found a copy of some council meeting that he was back in, you know, back in 1985. And they were talking about the fishing that was really important. And that made me start thinking about the drift net fishing and all of the things that we're doing. There's just no respect for the great mother. And Kerry, this is where your children come in. So just give them a little spruik too, my little niece and nephew. I've been helping them a lot on their journey to parenthood as well, which has been great.
It has been really lovely. But because we lived so much of our lives in rural and remote areas of Australia, and because we had a lot of on-country experiences, my children ended up moving, and I think Gilly and Brody were able to count that they'd been to 9 different schools throughout their time. Not finished 12, which is interesting for me because I believe that there are so many different kinds of literacies that people can experience, whether that be emotional, whether it be able to walk into a room and read it, whether they're able to work within a trauma framework that actually represents their own lived experiences. So I never forced them to do anything like that. And interestingly, my son has just been medically discharged from the military where he served, and I am so proud of the contribution that he made to the future security of our nation, even though First Nations people are still unacknowledged for our sovereignty. And as being First Nations people in this country, the fact that he could go off and provide for us the level of security which is not afforded to a great many people around the world is extraordinary. And my daughter, she used to be a fantastic door slammer back in the day. I'd go and take her door off. So I'd get the screwdriver out and take a door off and pull it out in the backyard, and she'd go and get it back on and then put it back on. So actually, you know, we had a couple of sideline gigs, which was around houses and renovation. Part of my motivation for doing that was because I was a single parent, father's unknown on both of the birth certificates, and if I died, because I was travelling around in a lot of little single engine aircraft at the time, and they were dropping out of the air like flies there for a moment, I just thought, well, who's going to be there to look after my kids? So I've always had a mortgage so that I could provide for them, but now they're both doing biosecurity work. So Brody is working in my company at the moment, and my daughter is an avian bird specialist down in Moonlit Sanctuary and does things like the orange belly parrot release. And she's about to go and do her master's in the kind of environments for black-tailed cockatoo or black cockatoos. So even though they didn't finish high school, I never put any pressure on them. They said, you didn't want us to achieve academically. I went, you've got to follow your passion. That's all I've ever done. I've always ever been curious about what the potential and opportunities are. And I don't believe that a 20th century education system serves everyone. And I don't believe in that because I think that in the Anthropocene, there are going to be so many different new look workforces, and good luck to us if we're able to craft them. So the new look workforces that we've been able to create through First Thousand Days are the cultural mentors, which is based on reactivating all the roles and responsibilities and kinship relationships. We've also created peer researchers where you have 15-year-old ICE addicts doing interviews with other 15-year-old ICE addicts. And it's been a really fantastic way to overcome all the barriers to being employed. I've really advocated for businesses, and now I'm doing things like negotiating for Indigenous inclusions in free trade agreements and having access to billions of dollars of direct investment. And all of those things are going to catalyse health and well-being by making our Indigenous estate recognised and valued for what it truly is. So that's where I'm at the moment. Just bought a little hill up the road because I loved the view so much I bought it. and setting up now an Indigenous botanicals extravaganza where we're going to be growing native foods and distributing that, and really starting to, again, heal country in a very powerful way.
Bringing back the bees.
Bringing back the bees, baby. We've all got to be pollinator protectors. So we've really got the opportunity to do some fantastic work in building up our insects and the capability of insect populations, because without them, we've got 4 years left in that it. Interesting how a social work degree followed by a PhD in environmental science with a research background and then catalyzing business opportunities both domestically and internationally. I feel like I've lived a good life and I've lived my own life. It's been a very passionate one, a bit like my nieces, really. You just go off and do what you need to get done in order to feel happy and that you're doing things that align with your values and your purpose and the sense of meaning.
I'm so proud. I'm so proud of everybody. I've got such a big heart swell. So thank you everyone for coming on the show. But what would be your advice to any young Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islander person who may be interested in either studying or, you know, following their passion? Kerry, I'm going to start with you.
Just do what makes you happy.
Kayla.
I would say just start looking it up. One thing a day, just get your foot in the door and just have a look at what you need to do.
Amy, what's your advice for someone who wants to either study or follow their passion and they don't think they can?
Stay connected. Stay connected with your community, your family and your mob.
Aww. Thank you so much, my family. I've really enjoyed our conversation. And thankfully, the Wi-Fi lasted up here on the mountain. It drops out a wee bit. So we've only had a few dropouts. So thank you for sticking around and enjoy the yarn with my family. And just, you know, I'm so proud of the legacy. You know, I feel like there's a lot of interweaving in our work and the legacy that we can leave behind for seven generations to follow, hopefully.
Bye.
Yawar, everybody. Yawar, yawar.
Thanks for listening to Indigenous Health Med Talk with Dr. Danielle Arabina. Please subscribe to the podcast and check out our YouTube channel, Indigenous Health Med Talk. This podcast is a General Practice Training Queensland initiative, supported by Australian General Practice Training and the Australian Government.